I wonder what the most daunting thing you have ever done is. You know the sort of thing where as the clock ticks down inexorably towards it, you get butterflies in the pit of your stomach and you begin to feel anxiety creeping slowly up your spine, your mouth goes dry, you start to sweat and you can feel your heart racing. I guess for some of our youngsters recently that's been the first day at school, although my hunch is they've had less of that than their mums who've dropped them off. Maybe it's the moment you dropped your child off at university and you left them all alone with that strange bunch of people in that not very salubrious looking accommodation to fend for themselves for the first time. Or maybe it's the feeling as you walk into that new job where actually you've got no idea how on earth you got it. You were convinced the interview that you'd blown it, so you didn't really listen to exactly what your job was going to be, and you walk in on that first morning thinking, well, I don't think I'm the person, and I have no idea what I'm going to be doing while I'm here. Maybe it's facing surgery. Maybe it was telling your parents you've crashed their car. You know, you go and you open the door tentatively and, oh, is Dad going to explode? What's Mum going to say? Will they ever let me touch something with four wheels again? Maybe it was your wedding day. Maybe it was giving a best man speech. Maybe it's facing someone to try and resolve a conflict. And you're just not sure how it's going to go. All of those things are daunting, aren't they? All of us will have experienced at least one of those, if not a number of them. Interestingly, I think many of us feel the same way when it comes to telling others about Jesus. It is daunting. What will I say? Will I fumble the conversation? How are they going to react? Will they laugh at me, reject me, get angry, or just be indifferent, shrug and carry on? Will they ever speak to me again? We know that we are called to share the good news of Jesus. And when we're sat in church and we're hearing the gospel taught, we think, yeah, I've got to share that with people tomorrow. And then Monday comes and you walk into the office and that daunting feeling arises again. We do better to resolve to share it every Sunday, but then come Monday, there's just those nerves. And how do I do this? Now, I can't help but wondering if that's because we think of evangelism wrongly. We think of it as our mission, and we forget that actually what we are holding out to people when we hold out the gospel is something that isn't going to ruin their life, it's not going to stop them having fun, it's going to bring them real joy. As we come to Acts 8 and Philip's meeting with this Ethiopian eunuch, I think there's a lot here to teach us, not in terms of a how to do evangelism. Okay, don't look for six steps to perfect friendship evangelism here. That's not what this is about. I think here we see two particular things that we want to focus on this morning. The first is this. In evangelism, we are invited to participate in God's mission. I wonder who you think the greatest evangelist in Acts is. There's quite a list of candidates, isn't there? You've got Peter. You know, Peter preaches that brilliant sermon at Pentecost. And 3,000 people come to faith. That's pretty good evangelism, isn't it? That's up there. Then you've got Philip. Well, Philip takes the gospel to Samaria, and we hear in that city many people believe. And now here he is with an Ethiopian, and then he goes to Azotus, and by chapter 21, when we meet him again, he's got a ministry going on in Caesarea and the area. Then there's the Apostle Paul, who goes from a zealot persecutor of the church to the one who takes the church to, well, Ephesus, Corinth, all those cities that we're going to read of in the last half of the book. But actually not one of those is the greatest evangelist in Acts. Because the greatest evangelist in Acts, and it's vital that we see this, is God. Okay, God doesn't give the mission to the church. And it's their mission. God, Father, Son, and Spirit invite the church to participate with them on their mission. God has always been working to bring people into the joy of knowing Him, of sharing in the joy and delight that Father, Son, and Spirit enjoy in one another. From Genesis 3 onwards, You can see God at work in missionary activity. As he speaks to people, as he calls people, as he calls people, he's called to call other people to come and know him. The words that we read in Acts 1 verse 8, that verse that you've all memorized, okay, that call to go and take the gospel, to witness about Jesus to Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria and the whole world, is not a new mission. He's giving it to a new people, the church, but it is not a new mission. It is just a continuation of what has always been God's mission. And that needs to just transform the way we think about our evangelism, about witnessing to our friends and family and our neighbourhood about who Jesus is. Now, chapter 8 zooms in on Philip. And Philip is an example of those who are scattered by the persecution that Saul kicks off, and they take the gospel wherever they go. So last week in verses 5 to 25, we saw him preaching to many Samaritans. And here we see him one-on-one with one individual. Now it's important to see what is stressed here is not a method of evangelism. You can find all sorts of sermons that are, they vary from 3 steps to 9 steps that Philip makes, and which we can use to be successful personal evangelists. The Bible doesn't do that. Okay, Luke's not giving us 6 steps, 3 steps, 27 steps or 1 step. What he is showing us here is that God is at work to bring people to know Jesus. That's the key thing. God is at work, and Philip is invited to participate in what God is already doing. So look at verse 26. No buzzers. The angel of the Lord said to Philip, go south to the road, the desert road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. Just think for a minute about Philip. Philip's been in this city in Samaria. Loads of people have been responding to the gospel. Loads of people coming to faith in Jesus as the Messiah, the one who died for their sin. I wonder if we were planning it, what we would say the next thing Philip should do is. My hunch is we would say Philip should stay there and do follow-up. He should do some group Bible studies with these people. You know, he should just help make them really, really firm in the gospel. Or maybe following on from chapter 8, verse 25, where Peter and John then leave that city and they go to other places in Samaria and take the gospel. Maybe we would say, well, the most strategic thing for Philip to do is to go to all of those villages and towns and follow up on what Peter and John have done. I don't think we would be saying, leave a thriving, gospel-responsive city and go to a dusty desert road miles away. But God redirects Philip because it is God's mission. God is at work because God's strategy matters, not ours. So look at verse 27. So he started out, and on his way he met an Ethiopian eunuch. What strikes you about this Ethiopian eunuch as you read through is the man's spiritual hunger. God is behind everything, directing things so that they meet. God is at work in the timing of their meeting. But what really strikes you is that God has been at work in this man long before Philip started his journey. He is hungry for the gospel. He's travelled from, right, Ethiopia. Okay? But actually, Ethiopia then, the bit that they termed Ethiopia, would now be modern-day Sudan. Now that's a phenomenal journey to make. I couldn't find out exactly how far, but reading different things this week, it's pretty clear it's over 1,000 miles as a round trip. Now that's quite a trip, isn't it? Imagine taking 1,000 miles to go to church. We sometimes moan about 25 minutes. And here he goes, 1,000 miles to Jerusalem or back. Now, just imagine someone appeared this morning and they've made 1,000-mile journey to come to Grace Church this morning. Most of us would be thinking, what on earth are you doing? Okay? But actually, here's this man, and he wants to go. And look what he's been doing. This man had gone to Jerusalem to worship. He is so desperate to know God. He knows something of God, probably because of the scattering of God's people. This man doesn't in many ways represent the Gentiles coming to faith. That's chapter 10. This man represents those who already know something of God, who are already following God. And here he is, and he's so hungry that he takes this trip. One commentator suggests it was 5 months each way. He takes a year off work to go to Jerusalem. Now, isn't that staggering? Think about over 1,000-mile round trip, 5 months there, 5 months back. And he goes specifically to Jerusalem to worship. This is a man who is spiritually hungry and thirsty. And his spiritual hunger is amplified even more when we read that he was a eunuch. Now that means in the temple, he couldn't get very close to God. He was really limited in terms of his access to God. He had to go, he could get to the temple, but he would be on the outer fringes of the temple. But even knowing that, he's been desperate to go. Because he's hungry to know God. But actually what you see is you carry on. Look at verse 28. And on his way home, he was sitting in his chariot reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit told Philip, go to that chariot and stay near it. Then Philip ran up to the chariot and heard the man reading Isaiah the prophet. Do you understand what you are reading? Philip asked. How can I? He said. Unless someone explains it to me. Now what you notice about this man is that going to Jerusalem hasn't satisfied his hunger. In fact, in some ways, it's just stoked it even more. He is sat in his chariot on the way back reading from the book of Isaiah. Now, don't miss the nature of what he's got. He has not got one of these, okay? My hunch is that you've probably got 5, 6, 7 Bibles at home. This man has got a scroll. Now, the scroll of Isaiah in those days took somebody 3 days to copy out, okay? 3 working days. You would pay a scribe, they would work for 3 days. You would pay them 3 days' wages plus the tools and the materials that they had used. This was an expensive undertaking. Imagine a Bible that cost you 3 days' wages. Okay? Plus, you then got to pay for the materials, and they'd be more expensive than we would pay for them. This is a man who is desperate to hear from God. This man is desperate to know God and to know what that means for him. And we also see that this is God's mission, because God is sovereign over what the eunuch is reading. Isaiah is a book, if you read it, speaks of the nations coming to know God. One of the big themes of Isaiah is God being known through the coming servant, the Messiah, and him bringing and gathering the nations to know him. And it includes a special promise for eunuchs of a lasting inheritance, an everlasting name. As Philip sees the chariot, he's told to stay near it. As he does, he hears the man reading out loud. And that's interesting. That's the way they always read the scriptures then. Actually, it's helpful for us to read the scriptures out loud. Obviously not if you're on a train. Okay, but actually, it's helpful to read it out. We read things differently when we read it out loud, don't we? We put more inflection into it, more tone. We think more about what's going on as it's read. Philip sees and seizes this opportunity in verses 30 and 31. He asks him, do you understand what you are reading? How can I, he said, unless someone explains it to me. So he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. You see, God is at work in everything here. God's been at work far before this point. I think the journey took 5 months. This man has been spiritually hungry for a long time and searching. God is at work in the man. God is at work in his hunger. God is at work in inviting Philip and bringing them so that their paths cross. And Philip is just getting to participate in God's mission. I wonder if that's how we think of mission. If we think of mission, of evangelism, as our job, our responsibility, it is utterly overwhelming, isn't it? That we can't do it. We can't. Mission isn't our job. Instead, we're invited to participate with God in his mission, empowered by him, by the Spirit, and that makes the world of difference. You and I cannot create spiritual hunger in people. God can. We can't create a thirst for knowing peace with God, but God can. We can't create a dissatisfaction with the world, but God does in this man, who in many ways had a great life. High position, access to good things, wealth. We can't bring people to see Jesus, but God can. We just need to just adjust our thinking. God doesn't send us out on our own, or even in little groups, or even as a church to take up our mission. He invites us to participate with him, Almighty God, on his mission. I think there's something else helpful here as well. We need to be alive to where God is already at work. We need to be alive just to God-given opportunities. We need to be alive, looking for those that God puts across our path who are dissatisfied with life and looking for something more. Sometimes you meet someone, and just as you randomly meet them, you can just, you know, you start talking about something and you get a sense of they're just being dissatisfied, they're wanting more, sometimes even looking for answers. I remember randomly when we were discussing coming over here to work for BEC, Lucy's sister thought we were mad, okay? But actually, when they were on holiday, they were in an airport in Florence and they got delayed and they were sitting next to a couple, they got chatting. Oddly enough, she was in a church that knew us and that had been praying for us and was able to explain more to Lucy's sister about actually why on earth we would go and leave a nice comfy job and a nice comfy house to go and work for a church. Now, it hasn't yet led Sally to faith, but you think about that, what are the chances of all the people in Florence, in an airport, the plane being delayed, of them sitting next to each other and actually getting into a conversation that is about the only person in common that those two people have in the whole world? See, God given opportunity. We need to just be alive to those things. Now, that's not saying we only witness to Jesus when we come across someone randomly who happens to already have an appetite to Jesus and it's really, really obvious. Because notice, Philip hasn't done that in Samaria. He doesn't get to Samaria and it says everybody there had the scroll of Isaiah and was reading it and was saying, what does this mean? It doesn't say that, but when it goes to Azotus or to Caesarea. There is a spiritual hunger in Samaria. But here he's given a unique particular opportunity with a unique particular individual in whom God is already at work and he is alive to it. Philip's default mode is to share the gospel, to witness to Jesus, to participate in God's mission. That needs to be our default mode, but we also need to be asking every day, Father, show me today who particularly you would have me talk about Jesus to. Father, give me an opportunity to participate in your mission of winning the lost. And help me just be alive to those opportunities. And help me not be saying, well, I'm too busy doing this to stop and talk to that person. I just want you to pause for a moment. Let's just pause and think about people that you know who God might be giving you opportunities with at the moment. Just think about people that you've come across, maybe someone at work, maybe someone in your family, maybe someone on your street, maybe someone in your community, maybe someone at the school gates, maybe someone at something you go to, a club or whatever you're a member at, who actually you just wonder if, well, maybe God has just brought me across this person for me to be able to witness to Jesus about. Why not just take a moment, just pray that prayer. Father, give me an opportunity with them to participate in your mission of winning the lost. See, in mission, we are called to participate with God who is already at work. Here's the second thing. The second thing is this. We help people find joy in Jesus. And sometimes we can find ourselves sharing the gospel a bit reluctantly, can't we? And we almost approach it with a sense of, well, being apologetic. Almost as if we were like those people that you see in town. You know, it's like I was there yesterday morning. You nip in and you spot them. Two people with something stuck in the middle and they've got their clipboards. And what do? You put your head down and you rush past because they're trying to get you to, I don't know, pay £2 to save the panda or have solar energy or whatever else it is. You know, and you kind of see them coming and think, oh, I don't need that. Now, interestingly, you chat to those people. That's the way a lot of them feel. They know they're going to get rejected by 95% of people. That 95% of people have no interest at all in what they're doing. I think sometimes we can find ourselves thinking like that person. Well, I need to offer this because I have to, but really no one's interested. Really there's no benefit. Really it's not really going to change life for them. We wouldn't ever say that, but I wonder if sometimes that's how we think. I'm not really holding out for them real joy. Now, we just need to come and see what God is telling us here, what he tells us through the whole Bible. When we hold out the gospel, we are offering people forgiveness, salvation, eternal life. We're offering them what they were made for. Relationship with God. What everybody has an internal hunger for, whether they realize it or not. What they will restlessly search for until they find it. Jesus Christ, who reconciles them with God. Now, hopefully, you see that here in Acts 8. You see, this Ethiopian eunuch's been very, very religious, hasn't he? You couldn't get more religious. 5 months there, 5 months back, a year off work. None of us have done that. You know, a scroll that's taken somebody 3 days to copy out and he's paid a fortune for. This man is incredibly religious. Hopefully here we see that our mission is just to help people not find religion, but to find Jesus and therefore find joy. Luke records for us what the Ethiopian is reading. Look at verses 32 and 33. He's reading from Isaiah 53. Now, the idea isn't that he's just reading these two verses, by the way. The idea is that this is the bit that he is reading when Philip comes across him. Turn to Isaiah 52 and 53. If you've got a church Bible, it's 702. The little section begins at 52 verse 13. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any human being, and his form marred beyond human likeness. So he will sprinkle the nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by others, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. Like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was punished. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring and prolong his days. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. You see, Isaiah there introduces this character, the servant of the Lord. And as the Ethiopian is reading this, his question is, who is it? Who is this one who is exalted after being disfigured? Who cleanses not just Israel, but many nations? Who suffers for my sin, for my rebellion, and brings peace? Who is this one who willingly bears my punishment for my rejection of God, even though he never did anything wrong? Who is this one who rises again, having justified many and borne the sin of many and brought back man and God? His question is the question to ask of Isaiah 53. Who is the prophet speaking about, himself or someone else? You can't help thinking that Philip's out there going, oh, yes. Oh, God, thank you. What a great opportunity. I couldn't have planned it better. What does Philip do? Verse 35. Then Philip began with that very passage of scripture and told him the good news about Jesus. What's the good news? We are rebels. We are under God's judgment for rejecting him. We deserve what Jesus gets, but Jesus goes to the cross in our place. He bears our sin, rises again to justify, bring us back to God, to take the punishment for our sin, to have borne all the wrath that we deserve to face. And he rises to bring us new life with God, reconciled, reconnected, to live life out as God intended it. Philip sits and explains that to the Ethiopian eunuch, that Jesus was the servant and he's the son. He's the one who left everything on heaven to come to earth. He's the one who faced rejection. He's the one who was unjustly sentenced. He's the one who's crucified on the cross in our place, who bore us in yet rose, guaranteeing forgiveness, reconciling us to God. To the Ethiopian, saying, look, he's the one you've been looking for. He's the one you went to Jerusalem to search for. He's the one you've been longing for God to show you. And he has been. As the Ethiopian hears the gospel for the first time, his thirst is satisfied. Look at verse 36. As they travelled along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, look, here is water. What can stand in the way of my being baptized? What does that tell us? It tells us he's seen who Jesus is, he's repented of his sin, and he's accepted Jesus Christ as his Saviour and his Lord. And he's baptized. That's a great question, isn't it? If you've not been baptized, that's the question to ask. Not why should I, but what can stop me? What can stop me? The answer is nothing if you've accepted him as your Saviour. Our mission is to help people see Jesus. That's what Jesus said in Acts, isn't it? You will be my witnesses. It's what Peter does on the day of Pentecost. It's what Stephen does in Acts 7. It's what Philip did in Samaria. It's what Philip does here with this Ethiopian eunuch. To tell others what we know of Jesus, what he's done for us, what he's done for them, who he is. That isn't saying that's all we do, by the way. There may be times when we need to help people overcome those defeater beliefs they have. Those things that they think mean Christianity isn't true. Those barriers to coming to Jesus. Things like, you know, well, is the Bible reliable? If God is loving, why would he judge? If God is loving, why is there so much suffering? Well, we do need to do those things. We need to knock down those barriers. But actually, we haven't kind of pushed all the way in terms of mission until we bring them to the point where they see who Jesus is. Now, with the Ethiopian eunuch, Philip doesn't need to do any of that. We come across some people where actually we don't need to do any of that. But other times we will need to. It's right that we knock down those barriers, but we mustn't just stop at knocking down barriers. Evangelism, God's mission that God has always been about, is helping people find Jesus. That's our mission. Now, do you see the privilege that is ours? We are invited to join God on his mission, to participate in it empowered by the Spirit. We're called to help people see and meet Jesus. And what does that bring? Look at verse 39. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord suddenly took Philip away, and the eunuch did not see him again, but went his way rejoicing. Interestingly, reading the commentaries this week, they make quite a lot of the start of verse 39 and very little of the second half. I think we're meant to make it the other way around. Yes, he does disappear. It's not Star Trek Transporter. We don't know what happens. We're not given the details. But what we do get told, this Ethiopian eunuch goes on his way rejoicing. I can't help thinking there's a deliberate contrast here with that Simon, who we met in the previous section. Simon supposedly comes to faith, is baptized, but do you know what does he do? He keeps on following Philip around. What does the Ethiopian eunuch do? I don't need Philip, I've got Jesus. Do you see? He's found joy. He's found what he's been searching for the whole of his life. And actually, that's the same reaction you get in chapter 8, verse 8. When Philip preaches to the Samaritan city, it says this: so there was great joy in that city. Why? Because people had found Jesus. Knowing Jesus brings joy because it's what we were made for. Let me just ask you, those who've been believers a long time, have you got joy leakage? You know balloons, you pump a balloon up, when there's a slow leak it gradually goes down, doesn't it? Until you're left with something kind of wrinkly and kind of rubbery and just looking quite unpleasant. That can happen to us as Christians, okay? We start off kind of full of joy and gradually it just leaks away as bitterness gets in, or as we just take our eyes off Jesus, as we start forgetting grace and focusing on what others have done to wrong us instead of quickly forgiving them. This passage comes to us and says, look, the response to knowing Jesus is joy. This morning, as you've heard Isaiah and what Jesus has done for you, you should be full of joy. But actually, we instinctively love shedding joy, don't we? Or sort of spreading joy. That's why as parents, you know, have you ever bought your child something so great that you almost can't wait to give it to them? You know, you buy it early in a sale and their birthday's 3 months away and you're thinking, 3 months I've got to wait, knowing how, in, you know, their big smile that'll be on their face when they open Tracy Island, you know, or whatever it is. Do you know that feeling? Why do we feel like that? Because we love bringing joy to those that we love. That's why those moments on Christmas morning, you just want to set a video camera up in the corner of the room, don't you? So you can see the faces light up as they, well, as the grown-ups open their presents and the kids play with the box. That's why you get those smiles of the happy couple on the wedding day. Joy, we love seeing and spreading joy. It's impossible to remain grumpy, isn't it, at a wedding where a bride and a groom are beaming? Well, it should be. If not, you've got a serious problem. You know, joy, we love it. We love sharing in it. Now, the danger is that we believe the world's lie that joy can be found somewhere other than Jesus. We believe that joy can be found in stuff or relationships or money or sex, and that somehow in calling people to Jesus, we're calling them to give up joy. We can find ourselves thinking like that. That the gospel is pale imitation joy compared to the immediacy of what the world offers. Have you found yourself thinking that? Has that little thought worm got into your head? We believe that lie when we forget or we don't act as if in witnessing to Jesus we are sharing the only thing on the whole universe that will bring real, lasting joy. A joy that isn't grounded in circumstance or wealth, but endures through suffering and struggle and hardship because it gifts us by grace what we are made for now and will enjoy for all eternity. How do you think of evangelism? God invites us to join with him, to share in his joy at seeing others discover the joy of knowing Jesus. He invites us to play a part in helping others come to realize for the first time what they were made for. He invites us just this morning just to remember the joy that is ours as his people, called and saved and filled with the Spirit. And God invites us to participate in his mission, to take joy to a world that needs it. Not a temporary, seasonal, momentary until the next thing comes along joy, but a joy that will echo forever into eternity. How is your joy in Jesus this morning? How is the way you think of mission? We are called to participate in God's mission to bring joy to the world.